Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 3rd, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, Mr. D.R. Tucker?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. Are you wearing your snorkel jacket and mittens and snow boots? Because, you know, this past week, Mr. Obama went to the Arctic to tour the Arctic. Did you see anything about that?
Yes, it was the first time a president has visited the Arctic, and it got, I would say, a moderate amount of coverage. You know, it could be better as these things go, but I was impressed in particular by the coverage of NBC News. The NBC Nightly News did a number of comprehensive segments about the Obama, President Obama's trip, including a very lengthy segment about those who will be displaced by human-caused climate change, which is probably one of the very rare times that the mainstream media has covered that particular aspect of the issue. So I was glad to see the coverage, and of course the White House itself did a lot of extensive social media coverage of the trip as well, which is nice to see.
So Mr. Obama went to the Arctic basically to call attention to the question of climate change, which most people know or have heard, at least, that the Arctic is warming even more quickly than the rest of the planet. And I decided to ask myself the question, why is that true? Why is the Alaska getting warmer faster than the near the equator? And it turns out it's a fairly complex answer with a lot of sort of drivers. But one of the reasons that the Arctic is getting warmer faster is the following, is that because the sunlight in the past, for the past 10, 20, 30,000 years, the sunlight has reflected off the snow up in the Arctic. And what happens is that white light, for various reasons, is able to escape the atmosphere. The energy is tied up in white light, not in infrared, so it reflects back out. As you begin to melt that ice, there's a positive feedback, right? So now when the ice is melted, the ocean is exposed, the ocean is dark, it tends to absorb and reflect less light, absorbs more energy, and then you melt more ice. And so there's this positive feedback where the Arctic tends to show the effects of climate change much more rapidly than, say, at the equator. And that's why it's often called a canary in the coal mine from a climate sense. And that's why the president visited the Arctic as a showcase for climate change stuff.
So. Exactly. The irony of it being a canary in the coal mine, thanks to the coal mines.
Yes, well, I mean, it's kind of a truism of environmental science that I've read in various places, but the more extreme and rugged an environment, like the desert or the Arctic, say Alaska, I mean, the more fragile it is, sort of the more dependent on specific conditions it is. And so here you see an example where the Arctic is really getting hit hard, with lots of damage, because of climate change. But when the president went to the Arctic, just before, he made an announcement, DR, and I'll let you tell us whose name he changed to what. And we'll sort of get that out of the way, because it seemed to me it was sort of it stole a lot of the oxygen from the discussion of climate change. But what did the president do about a mountain up there?
Yes, so I thought it was a tempest in a teapot, but it seems to have gone beyond the teapot. It was announced right before the trip that he was going to restore the name Denali, the Alaskan native name for the high, for I believe the highest mountain either in the United States potentially or possibly in the world.
Which North America, called, I think. The highest mountain in North America.
In North America, rather, which has been called which has been known as Mount McKinley for I believe about the last 100 years, being named after the late President William McKinley, even before he became president, basically to honor it was done it was the name was given to that mountain
Right.
by someone who basically wanted to give a thumbs up to Mr. McKinley's presidential campaign. President Obama decided to restore the name Denali, which had been called for thousands of years prior to the Mount McKinley thing, and it generated a lot of odd complaints from the Ohio congressional delegation, since Mr. McKinley was from Ohio, but it's gotten a lot of praise from the Alaska congressional delegation. And it just seems to be such a strange, trumped up
Oh,
controversy,
yeah.
no pun intended, because as Nancy Letourneau of the Washington Monthly noted in a great piece, that this was about Obama fulfilling, basically completing the work that he's long completed during the course of his administration of addressing the needs of Native Americans, that this was something that Native Americans felt very important about, that the name Denali was essentially stolen by this guy who basically renamed the mountain, and they just wanted that original name restored. So there's no real reason for it to be a controversy.
Right. I think that I guess I would sum it up by saying a tweet or someone's comment who said, "Why was President Obama naming a mountain after a GMC sport utility vehicle?" Right. Anyway, we'll leave it at that. So we have this crazy controversy about Denali, but the other big sort of thing to point out, the thing people should think about in terms of the president going to the Arctic is that he's trying to highlight the fact that the Arctic Ocean and the whole Arctic region of the world is becoming much more politically important and much more because of climate change. Right? So what's happening is the ice is in fact melting much faster than anyone thought. I remember when I first started paying attention to climate change issues, probably 10, 15 years ago now, the predictions were that the ice would melt by the year 2050 in the Arctic. And it's already happening now. And what's going on is that there are there's tourist uses. You can sail cargo ships across the Arctic. You can, of course, drill for oil, which is a whole topic we'll get to in a little while. The whole and it becomes an arena for national ambition. Okay, Russia has a huge Arctic coastline in a way the United States doesn't, that Canada does perhaps. The U.S. has the northern part of Alaska, but this is an important part of the world in which a lot of tensions can come. And so I think, for my money, it's climate change has the fact that the Arctic is somehow in play in this international arena between Canada, Denmark, Norway, Russia, the United States. The fact that it's in play at all is this screaming alarm bell about climate change. But then on top of it, in its own right, it's become a political problem, right? If Vladimir Putin sails up and decides to try and take over the North Pole, and he's got 82 icebreakers sailing around up there, and the United States has one, well, you're in trouble from a political perspective, right? Does that make sense, or did I overstate the case?
Oh no, no, it definitely made sense, and which is why during the trip that President Obama made a call to have more of our icebreakers in the Arctic, basically to make sure that we don't lose a strategic, don't lose a strategic advantage in the Arctic. But the irony that everybody's sort of trying to control what ultimately should be under the control of Mother Nature is
Yeah,
very,
no, I
very
agree. I mean,
interesting indeed.
I mean, it's a signal of the new world we're moving into, right? Where all of a sudden the North Pole is probably going to be ice-free through a significant part of the summer, and that's just the geopolitical implications of that are big. And it seems to, I guess I would note just to sort of, I mean, I think part of the reason that we haven't been able to deal with the Arctic and the geopolitical implications of the melting ice up there is that if people in Congress admitted that the Arctic was melting, then they would have to give up their claim that climate change doesn't exist. Or it would be much, much harder to maintain that there's no such thing as climate change when you're spending $1 billion apiece to buy 80 new icebreakers, right?
Well, the usual out from that contingent is to just try to claim that it's all natural, if it's as if it's butter or juice or something like that, rather than being,
Right.
caused by our activities.
So I guess so. We'll put up. There was a very interesting discussion on Tom Ashbrook's radio program called On Point on NPR. A discussion about just the competing claims in the Arctic. I think it's important for climate hawks to recognize that those competing claims, to my mind, play second fiddle to the fact that this is clear evidence that the world climate change is happening. And I think Obama made that point several times, that, you know, the Arctic is there ahead of us, and it's where everyone else is going in terms of climate change.
Exactly.
So then I guess the other question, DR, is one that we have touched on a couple times here, with respect to Mr. Obama going to Alaska. So to set the stage, right, we've complained bitterly about the Obama administration allowing Royal Dutch Shell to conduct oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean, right? It goes right back to what we just talked about, that the whole area is now much more open to development. Mr. Obama has allowed that to go forward, and at the same time, he flies to Alaska and talks about climate change in what the news reports called apocalyptic terms, right? That we have to take action, we have to do something. So the question is he open to the charge of hypocrisy? And I guess I have an opinion, DR, but what do you think?
It's a multifaceted controversy. Bill McKibben and Michael Brune of the Sierra Club have been strongly critical of the sort of, shall we say, the incongruity of Obama giving the final approval to Shell right before going to the Arctic for this trip. There was also an interesting piece by Stephen Stromberg in the Washington Post for WashingtonPost.com, basically suggesting that it was not incongruous and arguing, number one, that if Shell is blocked from drilling, they'll drill somewhere else and emit carbon somewhere else. And number two, that the most important thing to address climate change is to reduce demand for fossil fuels, either by, as he writes, mandating reductions in their use or pushing for the implementation of a carbon tax. The other angle is an angle that was brought up by Steve Horn of desmogblog.com in an appearance on the Real News Network on September the 1st, in which he noted that in which he suggested that one reason why Obama signed off on the permit is that Obama's energy policy is built around enabling the consumption of our economy, a consumption-based, hyper-capitalism-based economy that depends upon allegedly cheap energy to function, and that therefore there has to be a reconsideration of the economic model in order for us to keep the carbon in the ground. This is an argument parallel to the arguments of Naomi Klein in the book and the upcoming documentary, This Changes Everything: Capitalism Versus the Climate. And the fourth angle of this, it was a great piece by Brad Plumer of Vox, who noted that, you know, regardless of one's opinion on whether or not Obama had the legal authority to sh stop Shell this time around, there may be future drilling leases scheduled to be up next year that
So
the
just to
Obama
make sure,
on.
so that everyone, so we're talking about future leases of areas in the Arctic where a different company could go and do drilling, right? So they pay for a
Exactly.
lease for a certain geographical area in the ocean, and you're saying there's more of those coming up?
Exactly. Brad Plumer writes that, quote, as Ben Geeman points out in National Journal, the Department of the Interior is currently scheduled to hold another round of sales for oil and gas leases in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas in 2016 and 2017. Environmental groups have been urging the Obama administration to postpone or cancel those leases. And obviously, in that case, if the Obama administration does postpone or cancel the leases, that will be a way of saying Shell no, so to speak. Obviously, the controversy concerning this particular permitting stems from the fact that Shell obtained that the right to exploit those fossil fuels in the Chukchi Sea during the George W. Bush administration, and the claim that the Obama administration could not legally stop it, but there's stuff in the future that the Obama administration appears to be on solid legal footing to stop, and they certainly should
I have a
basically say
feeling
Shell no.
those future leases will be the subject of some discussion. But I guess I
Definitely.
wanted to go back to the Bill McKibben piece, because I thought that was an interesting. He published it in, well, several places that I picked it up at Grist. There's also Climate Desk, I think, published it a lot of places. But basically, I think McKibben's point is that Obama is treating the lease in the Chukchi Sea as kind of a political issue where he can trade off the two sides. And one of his spokesmen said something like, well, if both sides are mad at us, we must be doing something right, right? If the environmentalists and the oil people are mad at us, then we're doing the right thing. And McKibben's point is simple, is that Obama is making what he calls, what you would call a category mistake. That is to say, the whole issue of the Chukchi Sea and drilling up there is not a political controversy. It's a physics controversy. And Obama says you can't negotiate with physics. Right? The oceans are going to get warmer if you let the sun, if you put the carbon dioxide in the air. And so that to say that somehow he's splitting the loaf in half and making, you know, we'll let Royal Dutch Shell go into the Arctic, but maybe we'll stop later leases. That doesn't comport with the fact that the physics of the situation is implacable and will not change. On the other hand, in the other person you mentioned, Dr. The guy at the Washington Post, I forget his name again.
Steven Stromberg.
Steven Stromberg. He makes a good point that essentially Obama can't run around playing whack-a-mole with each new drilling project, and that the real thing that the president is trying to do is to reduce the demand side, the consumption of oil, and then the oil will, these drilling issues will go away. Maybe that's true. I'm not sure. I continue to be confused by exactly how to think about this. You know, Obama may not have had much choice with the Chukchi Sea, the Shell lease, but I mean, McKibben's right. You just because everyone's kind of mad at you and you're politically in the middle, is the boat still sinking, right? Even though the mutineers and the Marines are not shooting at each other.
Well, I want to tie back to another issue that was raised, which is the great speech that President Obama delivered on August 31st about the climate crisis at the, I believe it's called the Glacier Conference in Anchorage, Alaska, which was just an extraordinary speech and one of the strongest speeches I thought he has ever delivered. It did get some criticism in social media on the grounds that Obama did not call upon people in the developed world, and specifically the United States, to consume less. And that ties back to what Steve Horn said on the Real News Network about Obama's energy policy being oriented around consumption. And I would argue in response to that reduction in consumption and a rethinking of the economy, that has to come from the bottom up, not the top down. I don't think any president can basically decree through rhetoric that you must be more wise and efficient in your use of energy. I think that requires people to
I think the last guy who tried to do something like that was named Joseph Stalin, right? to tell the economy what it had to do.
I think it's up to people to take a look at, to paraphrase the Michael Jackson line, the man or the woman in the mirror, and realize that they have to use energy more prudently, and you know to prioritize the protection of the environment for future generations. That's not something that can be driven by a president or any leader. That has to be driven by the people. The people have to demand change, and then the politicians respond, not the reverse. So unless there is a demand for change away from a consumption-based economy by the public, for the public to reconsider the way we're doing. I mean, this was essentially the core of what Naomi Klein, I think, was arguing in the book, that it's up to the people to change. And once the people change, the politicians will be forced to change.
Well, DR, as usual, you've said it well. We'll have to leave it there. Let me tell our listeners that they can check in to the links of most of what we talked about today at the MCAN blog. It's changed recently. It's now massclimateaction.net/blog. Right? So it's not a WordPress blog anymore. It's massclimateaction.net/blog, and you can leave a comment there. You can find us on Facebook. It's Facebook/massclimateaction. If you go there, share us so your friends can hear about us too. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher. You can get to us on iTunes Radio. You can download a mobile app. You can get a mobile app from Podbean, all these places. And you can get a mobile app, I think, from SoundCloud, all sources of the Climate Minute. You can find us on iTunes, of course, by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. Please rank us. It improves our visibility. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.